Today we are returning to Genesis in chapter 37. Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers. Puzzled for quite a while over this introduction. Because, of course, we think of chapter 37 as Genesis as beginning the story of Joseph. So why does chapter 37 of Genesis open with, "This is the history of Jacob"? It's an interesting question. You can actually go back through the book of Genesis and find introductions like this to other chapters and sections. Part of Genesis is identified as being the history of Isaac, and another is the history of Ishmael. But why, when the author begins to launch into the story of Joseph, does he say this is the history of Jacob? I alluded to this a couple of weeks ago, but one thing that I found in meditating on this is that each one of the patriarchs, we can find at the climax of their life a special relationship that they had with a son whom they had to give up in one way or another. This, of course, is primarily true of Abraham, who famously had to sacrifice Isaac, his own hand being the one to nearly kill his only heir. But the writer of Hebrews says that Isaac's act of faith that he chose to highlight was, by faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. I think this was probably, as I think I referred to when speaking on the story of Isaac, possibly one of the hardest things that Isaac ever did was to bless Esau in a way that was against his own desires. Isaac wanted to pass along the blessing of Abraham to Esau, and I don't think he wanted to give it to Jacob. I think that he really loved Esau and he really didn't love Jacob, but he saw whom God had chosen, and he bowed to God's choice. And he really, in one sense, gave them both up, because he was not able to pass along the blessing of Abraham to Esau, and Esau left and went to Seir. Although he did pass along the blessing of Abraham to Jacob, he also had to send Jacob away. He sent him to Syria for the purpose of taking a wife. So there we can see another type of Jesus who left his father's throne to come and take a bride, to redeem a bride, purchase a bride to himself with his own blood. So we have both in the lives of Abraham and Isaac this type of Jesus, Abraham sacrificing Isaac, Isaac sending out Jacob. So the story of Jacob, from God's perspective, appears to climax with the story of Joseph. Everything that went before is important, but it was kind of a prelude. Because what we have seen, God, the way that God has dealt with Jacob, is to take this guy who was a fighter and a scrapper and who wanted to get for himself the blessings that he thought were worthwhile. God was pleased with the fact that he thought that God's blessing was worthwhile, but obviously he had a lot of other things to learn. So much as God tied up all the promises that he had given to Abraham in the person of Isaac, I think that he tied up a lot of Jacob's love and aspirations and affections in Joseph, because Joseph was the son of Rachel. And Jacob loved Rachel, and Rachel had been taken from him. So although it's not explicitly stated here, I think we can probably deduce this was a large part of the reason that Joseph was so precious to Jacob, was that he was all, apart from Benjamin, who was a baby, he was all that was left of Rachel to Jacob. So sometimes the climax of a story doesn't actually come where we think that it should or has. We may think the story's over. You know, Jacob is 90-some years old at this point. You know, it's time for him to go into the nursing home and live out his golden years. And God introduces, or allows to be introduced, this new tragedy that's worse than anything that's happened to Jacob up to this point. God knows what he's doing, and we don't write the story. Another thing that I thought of with regard to this is that inasmuch as each of the three patriarchs is, in a way, a type of God, that is showing us something about the nature of God, all of history is the story of God. God is the main character. And sometimes we get this confused, we get it backwards, we're thinking of ourselves as the main character. And God comes on as a support, kind of a supporting role to make sure that we get whatever we want and that our story ends well. We are his creation. We are part of his story. This is the story of God. So everything that happens in the lives of his children and those that he has redeemed returns and reflects back on him. For his pleasure, all these things are and were created. So I began to sort of read it in that light, read the story of Joseph in light of what the Lord was doing in Jacob and in his people, in the people that came from Jacob and would become the people of Israel. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. It's not very surprising that we find all the trouble starting with the sons of the concubines. If you will recall, these men were those that had been conceived quite literally in envy and competition. That when Rachel saw she was not bearing children as her sister Leah, Scripture says she envied her sister and said to Jacob, "Give me children or else I die." And finding that he was not God and had no power to give her children, she took her handmaid and gave her handmaid to Jacob and said, "Here, I'll have children by this woman." And it's pretty clear to me this was not God's design. I don't think it was God's design for Jacob to have more than one wife to begin with. So we can see another sense in which this is the history of Jacob is that these are his choices being played out. We'll see the way that God redeems them, but nonetheless, the consequences are there. They're being lived out in the next generation. The sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, I don't think that they were very good men, it would appear. I don't think Joseph would have brought a false report to his father. But on the other hand, one has to ask, how did it feel for them growing up, knowing that they were kind of second-class citizens as being the sons of the concubines and not of Jacob's wives? So there were a lot of seeds sown for this discord and these problems many years before. Choices that Jacob made, that Rachel made, and that Leah made, the consequences now of which are being reaped now. And this is an important thing to remember, that the choices that we're making do not affect ourselves only, but others, and even succeeding generations, are going to be paying the price or reaping the benefits of the choices that we're making. Abraham's descendants got to reap the benefits of the choice that he made to obey God. And we, as his children by faith, are still reaping those benefits. But there are also consequences to be dealt with. And we're seeing some of those here. "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. Also he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." So there it is again. Jealousy. Saw it with Rachel. Now we're seeing it again with Leah's children and the children of the handmaidens. Turning around and coming back. The jealousy that was sowed is being reaped. Rachel's own son is now the victim of it. I don't think that she ever would have imagined this, that her son would be the victim of the jealousy that she sowed herself. He wasn't around to see it. But Joseph had to deal with it. It wasn't his fault. He didn't do anything. At this point, he'd done nothing at all, except be the object of his father's special affection. And whether Jacob should have been so demonstrative about the special relationship he had with Joseph is another question. I don't know that the Bible specifically speaks to that, and I don't necessarily want to get into it today. What we can be certain of is that how Joseph's brothers handled this was completely wrong, and it showed that they loved themselves. They did not love their father. Because when you love someone, as we've talked about before, you love what they love. You desire what brings them pleasure. And Jacob's sons must have known how much it crushed Jacob to lose Rachel. And they must have known that his special relationship with Joseph had a lot to do with his losing his beloved wife. But their attitude, when they saw how much he loved Joseph, was to turn on Joseph with hatred. Jealousy is a manifestation, human jealousy is a manifestation of self-love. What it says is, self is entitled to whatever self wants. If someone else is getting it and I'm not getting it, there's something wrong. Someone has committed a crime, a sin, a blasphemy against the God of self by bringing an offering to someone and they didn't bring it to me. Joseph has this special love from Jacob. He's been honored with this coat of many colors, maybe an ornamented robe. There's a lot of different ways of translating it, but the point is it was a mark of special favor. It was something that he wore, and every time they looked at it, it just galled them because they were not thinking about what pleased Jacob or even how they could please him, obviously, how they could do what he wanted to, how they could honor him as their father and what would make him happy. They were thinking about themselves. Why haven't I been honored? Why haven't I been noticed? Who's going to give me a tunic of many colors? And that's where it starts, with thoughts, with grumbling, with sidelong glances. It wasn't dealt with. And I think it ended in a way none of them would have imagined when they started out. I mean, not very many people get up in the morning and say, I think I'll kill my brother. They don't plan to end up there. But that is where this obviously ended up. Verse 5, now Joseph had a dream and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. This is a very common theme among those who are resisting God. Very few people will say, I do not want to submit to God. Some will. Certainly hardly anyone who is calling themselves by the Lord's name is going to say, I wish to rebel against God. I do not want God to reign over me. So they instead turn their anger and their rebellion to those whom God has chosen, whom God has appointed. Joseph clearly had his father's special favor. And I would imagine there were pretty clear signs that he had God's favor as well. Now, was it wise on his part to tell this dream to his brothers? I don't personally think it was. I don't know whether he had some problems at this point. I mean, he is a teenager. He may have had some problems with a lack of wisdom or even pride. God was going to deal with those things, of course, if they were true. But essentially, what we have here is the flesh saying, we won't have God to reign over us. This was manifested later on with Moses. God sets up authorities, chooses people to lead us, chooses those who will have the rule for our good. And it is a manifestation of faith to submit to that and say, God knows what he's doing. They didn't realize they were talking about the man who was going to save their lives. Shall you reign over us? If he hadn't, they would have starved to death. But they couldn't see that at this point. They didn't have faith. So they resisted it. They chafed against it. This galled them. And one can see why very easily. I mean, he was their younger brother. But they did not approach the situation with faith. They gave in to the instincts of the flesh, which is somebody is trying to lord it over me, and it's my younger brother, and that's totally unacceptable, and he's a jerk, and why doesn't somebody shut him up? And eventually get to the point of, well, I think I'll just shut him up permanently. Because they allowed this to have control over them. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I have dreamed another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. I can see where this would have been pretty difficult for just about anybody to swallow. When a kid comes and says, yeah, I dreamed last night that the sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. Like, you are really getting full of yourself, buddy. What is your problem? But notice the reaction and the difference in reaction between Joseph's brothers and his father. I think that Jacob may have been, in what he said, partly correct. If indeed Joseph was manifesting an attitude that was not godly, I don't know. It's hard to say. He may have just been trying to be sure that it wasn't just absolute megalomania on Joseph's part. He had no way of knowing, of course, whether the dream was genuine or not. But it's interesting that no one disbelieved Joseph. No one dismissed him. Why not? I mean, that would be my reaction. My brother came and said, yeah, I dreamed the sun, moon, and 11 stars bowed down to me. I'm like, yeah, sure. You're really off the deep end, you think that. But no one reacted to it that way. His brothers envied him. You don't envy a kook. They must have thought there was something to this, or their reaction would not have been jealousy. The major significance, I think, of course, Joseph's dreams were actually fulfilled when he became ruler of Egypt much later, but I think the major significance of Joseph's dreams is very likely prophetic. And the fact that there were two of them may indeed show us something about, and I didn't get very far into this, so I won't here, but I'll just allude to it. The first coming of Jesus, when he said to his disciples, the harvest truly is great, but the laborers are few. That is, he came to reap God's harvest. The first dream is that of a sheaf. The imagery is that of a sheaf being exalted and the other sheaves bowing down to it. And at his second coming, the kingdoms of the world and all the cosmos will be subject to his authority and rule. And there you have the sun and the moon and the 11 stars. So, and he will also reign over the kingdom of Israel at that point, which is obviously what Jacob thought it meant, that is, that he and, I guess, Leah, because Rachel was deceased at this point, and the other 11 tribes would bow down. So I think these were prefiguring Christ. But the brother's reaction was jealousy. Jacob's reaction is translated here as, he kept the matter in mind. But interestingly, this particular phrase, the most frequent context in which you find it is keeping the commandments of God. So, literally, he kept the word. And this is the difference. Sometimes we don't need to judge things. There are things that just may not be clear yet. Something or someone might seem, we would say, a mixed bag. Like, there's some things there that seem right, and there's other things that don't seem quite right. So we're not sure, but we wait and see. What does God confirm? Who does he back up? What's the fruit of it? Is it love, peace, and joy, and righteousness, or is it going the other way? And that is to keep the commandments of God, not to simply react in the flesh, as Joseph's brothers did, burning with envy and jealousy against Joseph and just racking every one of these things up in their mind as an offense and an insult and something that they couldn't put up with. And if Joseph's brothers had had a proper attitude towards their father, this is what I see as the central theme here, is that Joseph's brothers didn't have the right relationship to their father that they should have had. They should have deferred to their father and what his attitude was with regard to Joseph, that he gave Joseph special favor, and he did not categorically say, this is wrong and you need to repent of being such a peacock. Their envy of Joseph was also a rebellion against their father. And the crime that they eventually committed was as much against their father as it was against their brother. Verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, here I am. I think this shows us something about the relationship that Joseph had with Jacob. It would be very surprising to me if Jacob could have said to any of his other sons, go and do this, and they would have responded, here I am. In other words, whatever you say, I'm going. And I've noticed as I've been reading through the Gospels again how often Jesus talked about doing the will of the Father as being that which separates the children of the world from the children of God. He said, for instance, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father which is in heaven. He said, whoever does the will of my Father, the same is my brother and my sister and my mother. So that's where the rubber meets the road. Do you do the will of the Father? Jesus said of himself, I seek not my own will, but the will of him who sent me. And Joseph might have had issues with pride and arrogance. I don't know. I don't think that's 100% clear. But he had one thing right. Like Jacob before him who obeyed Isaac, like Isaac before him who allowed himself to be placed on the altar by Abraham, like Abraham who obeyed God when God said, go out, he was obedient. He took the word that God spoke and said, you're the authority. I'm the one who's supposed to listen and do what you say. So he had the relationship right. Other things can be worked out. Other things can be taught and learned. But that relationship has got to be right. You've got to be in the right place, understanding that it is God who is the creator and the authority. And Joseph had that. Then he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks and bring back word to me. So he sent him out of the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, what are you seeking? So he said, I am seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. And the man said, they have departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. If you look closely here, you can see something else of the character of Joseph, which is that he really did go to do his father's will, not just to look like he was doing it. I'm sure he knew how his brothers felt about him. The writer says that they could not speak peaceably to him. That is, they couldn't, as some translations render it, say a kind word to him. Why would you go and look for people like that so that you can get more of their sneers and more of their snide remarks? Because his father told him to. Because the will of his father was that he should find his brothers and find out how they were doing. One can easily imagine he could have got to Shechem. Oh, they're not here. Oh, well, I guess I'll go home. But he didn't do that. He kept on seeking his brothers because it was the will of his father that he should do it. And here we see Jesus again. Because he came to seek and to save what was lost. He came to seek those who were not looking for him, who acted towards him exactly as Joseph's brothers acted to him. Who do you think you are? You're trying to tell us you were before Abraham? What is the deal? He kept looking for them and seeking them and even entreating them when they were clearly angry enough and jealous enough to kill him. He did so because it was his father's will. That struggle in the Garden of Gethsemane was over this very issue, where he said, Father, if you are willing, take away the cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. He came to seek what his Father had sent him to find. Verse 18, now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. Wow. Once again, this didn't just happen overnight. I don't think that they woke up that morning and said, you know, I never thought about this before, but we could actually kill this guy. I think this has been smoldering for a very long time. And it was not just that they were jealous. That was the main thing. It was also that Joseph was, he represented light, effectively, on what they were doing, because he went and reported it to their father. This was probably why they went to Dothan, and they probably why they didn't send word back as to where they were headed, because they didn't want to be reported on. Jesus said of the Pharisees, if I'd not come, then they wouldn't have thought that they had sinned, but now they have no cloak for their sin. He came as a light, and they love darkness. And so here they've run off to Dothan so that nobody will know where they are, and he's tracked them down, and they see him at a distance. It's like, okay, enough. We don't like this guy. He's a jerk. He thinks he's ruling over us. And here he is again to watch everything we're doing and go back and report it to our father. We're going to get rid of him. We should not take lightly any thought of the flesh that would take us down this road, because it's deadly. This is what led the Jews ultimately to crucify Jesus. Scripture says they delivered him for envy. They didn't want the light. They didn't want him to rule over them. And he was their Messiah, the one they'd been waiting for, the one they'd been praying for hundreds of years, and he showed up and they killed him. Then they said one to another, look, this dreamer is coming. Come, therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, let us not kill him. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit, which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him, and they took him and cast him into a pit. And the pit was empty, there was no water in it. And they sat down to eat a meal. It really is amazing when you think about how hard-hearted these men had become. That they could commit this act of violence and murder, that was what was in their hearts, that was what they wanted to do, they wanted to kill him, throw him into a pit, and he's down there, terrified, I'm sure, and they sit down to eat. This shows you something of the depravity of the human heart. I think it shows us something of why hell exists. Because those who will not have God to reign over them know no limits to their depravity, because they begin to be ruled by passions and lusts and desires that just don't stop at anything. Everybody looks at ISIS and says, wow, how could they be so barbaric? That is in every one of our hearts. It is the spirit of Lucifer, the murderer. It was jealousy of God himself that motivated Satan to say, I will be as God. And that is why he ended up in the pit himself. And we should not take it lightly. We ought to go the other direction from this. Not to allow self-love any place, but only the love of the Father. I don't think that the brothers gave a thought to their father at this point. They were just, except for Reuben, to his credit, he did think about it. And he tried to do something about it, but as we'll see, he didn't have what it took. And they sat down to eat a meal, then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." And his brothers listened. Then Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. Count on Judah to think of a way to make a profit on the deal. I don't think it's any accident that the one who sold Jesus for 30 pieces of silver was also named Judah, or Judas, as is rendered in the New Testament. Once again, there's a prefiguring going on. And it's really quite interesting. I don't mean this as a racial stereotype, but I think it is true that one thing that God has given to the Jews has been observed throughout centuries is their ability to make money. It has actually helped them to survive as a people in the interim since they rejected their Messiah. And this is precisely what the Jews did. They effectively sold their Messiah to the Gentiles so that we had this opportunity as the Gentiles to be saved. You know, there are no what ifs, but what if Jesus had been accepted by his own people? Would the Gentiles have had an opportunity? God keeps turning around the plans of Satan. Satan must have thought it was the greatest triumph ever when he convinced the Jews to sell their king into the hands of the Romans and crucify him. Because this was the same thing they did. They did not want their hands bloodied. So they gave him into the hands of the Gentiles. And literally so. Because then the gospel came to the Gentiles. But it will come back. It will come back to Abraham's children. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. I hadn't thought of this until just this second, but this is actually quite a lot like the scene of people coming to the tomb and finding Jesus gone. And not knowing what had happened, of course. So I wonder if there's something there too. But I haven't thought that through very well. And he returned to his brothers and said, "The lad is no more, and I, where shall I go?" It's a very good question. And I think the reason that he asked it is because he didn't know the answer. This had characterized his life. His father later called him unstable as water. He had some very good instincts, but he feared man. He could have taken a stand with his brothers, I think, as the oldest. He probably held a significant amount of sway, and he could have said, "No, we're not doing this. You guys are crazy. Knock it off." But he didn't do it. He tried to compromise. He tried to walk the middle line, so to speak, to fear God and fear man at the same time. "No, we're not going to kill him. Let's just put him in the pit and let nature take its course, and I'll come back later and sneak him out when nobody's around to oppose me." But it didn't work. You can have the fear of God, or you can have the fear of man, but you can't have both. If you try, you're going to fall off on the wrong side of the fence. Because you've got to be willing to go all the way. And Reuben was willing to go about halfway. And he wound up getting sucked into the lie. Because once it was done, he wasn't going to take a stand and confess what he'd been a party to. So he ended up being a party to the evil. So that's what you have to decide going in, is which one. You can't have both. Are you going to fear God, or are you going to fear man? So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "We have found this. Do you know whether it is your son's tunic or not?" This is so interesting to me. What Joseph's brothers did here was actually prophetic, and they didn't realize it. We're not sure exactly what the tunic of many colors was, as I alluded to earlier. But if indeed the traditional translation is correct, then it seems to me what it likely stood for, as Joseph was a very clear foretype of Jesus, was his being the ruler over all kindreds, peoples, and tongues and nations. So you have the rainbow colors representing all those peoples, and he is God's appointed ruler over all the earth. And they took that tunic and they dipped it in blood. Because not only is he the king over all the earth, he's also the redeemer of all those peoples. So the blood was on all the colors. And in Revelation, when Jesus returns, he comes the second time. He's riding on the white horse. He's clothed with a robe that's dipped in blood, just as Joseph's robe was. And this, I think you can see in the way the brothers handled this very much, the state that the Jews are in now is this kind of unanswered question that they have. Sending the robe to their father and saying, although of course it's duplicitous on their part, is this your son? There's a lot of doubt among the Jews about who Jesus actually was. Did we actually kill the Son of God? It's kind of an unanswered question. And he recognized it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces." It would appear from later passages of scripture that Jacob had some idea of what had actually happened. Because he later says to his sons, "Me, you have deprived of children." So it would seem that he knew they had something to do with it. He decided, for whatever reasons, to express it like this. But in a way, this was also true. A wild beast had devoured Joseph, and the name of the beast was jealousy. And Joseph was, in a sense, torn in pieces. I can't imagine anything so emotionally devastating, devastating at every level, than to be torn away from your family and everything you know, and made a slave and taken to a foreign country, you might as well be dead. I would imagine there were probably times when he wished he was dead. I was thinking about, I don't know the specific story, but I've heard a number of stories like this, where someone decides to take some wild animal and raise it as a pet, like, you know, a snake or a lion or something. And then that wild creature gets big enough where it finally kills them. And I think this is the wild beast that devoured Joseph. It's the wild beast that devours its own keeper, because it brings destruction. If you nurture it and think, it is so easy to justify. I mean, I can somewhat sympathize with the brothers reading through this and thinking that, you know, that was really galling. But that's not the way that God looks at it. And our job as creatures, what we are given to do, what we are commanded to do, is to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind. And there is nothing that has ever been given to anyone else that can stop you from doing that. The fact that someone else has special favor, someone else has other gifts. Peter tried to say to Jesus, "Well, what shall this man do?" And Jesus said to him, "What is that to you? Why do you care? Why are you even looking on what your brother has, thinking about how good he has it, how much easier, whatever? That's none of your business. Follow me." Your attention, your love ought to be, and your life ought to be directed to me, to Jesus Christ. And there's no excuse for it not being. Because when our eyes are on the Lord, then they're not able to look around the room and see who has something that I don't have that I think I should. And if we do not deal with that, crush that, kill that, then it develops into a spirit of hatred, which is a spirit of murder, which causes total destruction and grief. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted. And he said, "For I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning." Thus his father wept for him. I can't imagine that it was very pleasant to live around Jacob during those years, when he was in a permanent state of mourning. The brothers did themselves in. They destroyed the happiness of their own family because of this jealousy that they allowed to take over. Now, the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard, which seems like sort of a footnote, but it isn't, actually. Because if you think about it, Joseph could have been sold to anyone. He could have been sold to some obscure brickmaker and never heard from again. But God had his hand on Joseph. And God knew what the brothers were going to do. That doesn't mean that he caused it, but he did allow it for his own purposes. Just as he's allowed the Jews to be provoked to jealousy, he uses even the jealousy of man for his own purposes. And the jealousy of the Jews is eventually going to result in their salvation. It's kind of an unresolved issue at this point. The Jews are still somewhere between Genesis 37 and 40-something, wherever they are reunited with their brothers. But their action in rejecting their Messiah, I was going to maybe read this, but there wasn't really time. I was seeking the Lord this morning about the whole thing. I felt like my attention was drawn to the parable of the keepers of the vineyard in Matthew 21, where we find something very similar happening. That is, the father sends the son, says, "They will reverence my son." They see the son, say, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." And that's exactly what the Jews did to Jesus. But God took that and turned it into an opportunity for salvation for us. And all these things that were written before were written for our learning, so that we would not make the same mistakes, so that we would learn to humble ourselves in these situations and to turn our hearts toward the Lord and think about what pleases Him. Not, how does this affect me? How do I feel about it? How does God feel about it? Do we really love Him or not? Do we really want to see the things happen that bring His heart pleasure? He's the one that this story is about, remember. So may we be faithful to love Him with all our hearts.